We're deeply indebted to Dr. Strauss. Normally, at this point, there would be a break for refreshments, but I think that the ingestion of food would be unduly reminiscent of the corporeality, which ought not to be intruded on the attention at this point. And so there has been a change proposed, and Dr. Strauss has consented to accept the questions directly.
There was an objection. All right. Perhaps we can do it this way, that we have a subject prior to the food and one, three. One while we eat and one while. Now, all right, I open this question. There are so many objections possibly. So why did I speak so much about the mere experience of the book and not about the substance?
That is not a question. Not a question.
It's an objection. Yeah, I said objections. I am in honor.
Would you like then to explain why you have to carry on with
it? Yeah, because it's also part of the book. And if the author says that this book is written with exceeding care, one has also to consider the external. Furthermore, when one goes into the substantive issue, one gets into very great difficulties, which cannot be solved except by considering these things. But I give you a simple example. When I was much younger, I was about your age or a bit older, I tried to understand my mother's doctrine of providence. I was not interested in it for its own sake, but some accent. And it seemed so clear, but when I read a few more lines, I had to revise the sentence I had put down about it. And then revise it. And then after a few lines, I had again to revise it. So that was a strange, elusive response. And then I observed that he uses two terms for providence in Hebrew, Hashkaka and Hanhaka, and which we can translate where the one is providence and the other is governance. And he apparently used them synonymous. But somehow it didn't seem, there seemed also to be a difference. So I was compelled to make statistics through the book. And then I saw that there are large sections in which only governance occurs. And then there are other sections in which only providence occurs, and then other parts in which both occur promiscuous. Furthermore, and that became decisive for that, I saw that a reference to the chapters on Hanhaga, on governance, somewhere in 140 or so, which is ordinarily understood to refer to the section on providence, the first to that. Now, and you see, if Mahasenagama is the most important thing, if that means translated governance, then it's not incredibly important. I mean, after all, that follows without any understanding from the mere verbal expression. If the greatest thing is the Makara, the charity, and you can find a technical term, as a translation of that, that is, or must be of terrible importance for the understanding. Okay? And so I saw that such things like, for example, statistic of words are made, have to be made. Now, if that, you cannot know which external may not be important. Yeah? I mean, then one best in people, and I think the plant, I believe that I have never found it at least in any writing at this plant, and I think it is, I believe if you read, study it, you will find it helpful. And it is an absolute condition for, it seems to me, for understanding substantive issues. Now,
I would appreciate a word about secret in terms of some area of ideas or knowledge, secret, but it's in some sense a dimension of all the knowledge.
There is a clear division of subject matter. Well, clear in principle. But there are so many overlappings that you get into great troubles. I advise you to read chapter 35 of the first part, if I'm not mistaken, I'm almost sure. When Maimonides tries to draw a line, But one can say this, existence, unity, and incorporality of God cannot be secret teachings. Yeah? But the precise meaning of providence, for example, yeah, is belongs to secret teaching. One can also say the peculiar status of Moses, the highest of the prophets, is a secret, as is indicated by the following massive contradiction. On the one hand, Maimonides says that Maimonides is the only prophet who did not use his imagination, imagination being regarded as the lower part. Yeah? And then one can prove it from n pages in the guide that Moses did use his imagination. It's never clear. Let me put it this way, where in any subject regarding which there is a contradiction, there is a safe assumption that it is secret.
How do you harmonize the image of God with corporality, that is, with the human body, our shape?
No, I mean, well, what Maimonides says is that God is incorporeal and that the passage must not be taken literally. But still, if you have no knowledge and are suddenly confronted with this sentence, you might think God is a corporeal being. If God created man in his image or likeness, there would seem to be also an inverse relation. And hence that God would also be in the image or likeness of man. Yeah? And therefore look like man. After all, there were quite a few nations in the world which believed that the gods have human shapes. Yeah? I mean, pagans. And therefore, Maimonides is compelled to go into the whole question of corporeality. And there were also certain mystical doctrines in Judaism which in a mystical way spoke of the body of God. But somehow they did not simply reject the notion that God is corporeal. Although they did not mean it in that crude way.
I have two questions. One of them concerns a remark you made at one point that one concept which was applied to man and to God is not merely used homonymously.
There is used, that's the
There is one term, I think it was mind.
Intellect.
Intellect.
Yeah.
I would like a clarification of this issue. I mean, in what sense is this one not used, and in what sense are the others used?
Yeah, well, I can only say that's a fact.
Well, I mean, Maimonides explained this.
No.
Does he say this?
No. Maimonides is a... These 10 chapters, which are generally known as the chapters on the doctrine of attributes, 150-60, they come up with this final suggestion that all terms applied to God, have only the name in common with the terms, corresponding terms applied to men or any other people. And then, in fact, when you read this chapter 68, dealing with the mind, you see here is no homonymity but univocality. And especially if one takes the minor trouble of looking up the source of Maimonides' statement, that the intellect and the act of intelligizing, if one can say that, and the intellectum, the intellectism, are identical, because that many other stories put on the show, where it is said of man, and it would become still. Of the human life. That is so. I mean, that leads to a kind of question in one has to read and reread to understand it.
That was one question. And the other question concerns a reference to what you said, that Maimonides says that the people to whom the Torah was given were previously, I think he uses the word Sabians or
Sabians. I don't know how to pronounce it properly.
Well, that word...
I can write it.
But that word is definitely, it seems to me, of Islamic origin. I mean... Yes, I mean the use of this term. And now, I would like to know, if it can be stated in a few words, whether this is merely a passing allusion or whether Islamic theology has a large amount of place in this.
I think, I don't believe that, there are certain Islamic terms, for example, the term which he uses for unity, tawhid, is the Islamic term, you know. And there are other terms, the dunya, for this word, and this kind of focus. And of course, he used Islamic philosophers, but whether the Islamic philosophers were so models of Muslims is a very moot question, you know. And therefore, that doesn't quite fall under this heading. But I would say, no, I mean, the only the point, I mean, certain, there's some expressions, for example, this that I learned only a short while ago. He calls Moses Sayyid al-Alimin, which means the master of those who know, like Dante. You know? Only Dante calls others all the way. But then I asked my friend Mahdi, whom you know, he's a professor of Arabic here, and he told me, when I didn't know to my modification, that in the Quran, it doesn't mean Sayyid al-Alamin, but Sayyid al-Alamin. That said of Muhammad, and means the master of the worlds of men and angels. Now, that I'm sure cannot be interpreted as this expression, but by taking into account that it is a modification of a Quran expression. These things occur, but I think one, and also when you read, even in his Jewish work, in the code, the last section deals with kings and their wars. The description of the law of war reminds you of the Holy Book. I mean, that is somehow, surely from Deuteronomy, but there is a certain warlike element in it, which is not so obvious in Deuteronomy or in any other passage of the Bible, and which is naturally at home in Islam. So there are some symbols of this kind there, but whether I don't believe that they affect the fundamental point.
No, my question was specifically for the following reason. If I remember correctly, the question was raised in Islam with the Sabaeans, specifically Sabaeans, people who believe in the planets as gods, were or were not peoples of the book, that is to say, to be treated like Jews or Christians.
Yes.
Is there any connection between the specific use of this term and the specific kind of pagan, so to speak, which the Quran sees in the Sabaeans?
Well, I can answer this question. For Maimonides, the Sabaeans were certainly not, they did not belong to the Ahlul Kitab. I mean, they did not recognize any revelation that Maimonides emphasized. They were pagan. And now Maimonides relied, well, what Maimonides does is really quite extraordinary. Maimonides claims that he had understood all biblical laws, virtually. I mean, it doesn't it? And out of this grew a tremendous code, as you know. Now, and that leads to a very grave question, because Sabaeanism having disappeared, what is the use of these laws now? I don't want to go into that. And that is major, which we discussed when Dr. Pines gave his lecture a year ago. But how did Maimonides know of them? Of course, the remarks in the Quran, but they were in no way authoritative for him. But there was a certain literature which pretended to be sacred. And, you know, it brought up, this were Arabic writing people, and Maimonides refers to them, and he says he is right. And Maimonides somehow claims, but that is a bit unclear, that he takes this for granted, this is old literature, say, going back to the oldest. But there is also yet of course, also a source of knowledge of idolatry in the Talmudic discussion about the entomological biblical passage. But there is one other source which we must never forget, and that was that he had studied Aristotle. Now, Aristotle doesn't give many details of Greek mythology and Greek ritual, but enough to give him an idea. And there are at least two passages from the Ethics, or Aristotle's Ethics, which he quotes in discussing the biblical commandments. So the interesting problem is not that, although that should also be treated competently and properly, the interesting problem is this. Maimonides had two independent sources of paganism. or regarding idolatry, let me use Abu Dasara, the Jewish term. One is the Jewish tradition, Bible and Talmud. The other were the Greeks. You know, he knew it from both angles, as it were. And that leads to very interesting studies before we pursue that. The Sapiens appear in two entirely different lights. There are passages in which they are presented as seven Canaanite tribes are presented in the Bible and the Jewish tradition. And there are other passages in which they are presented as philosophers. I mean, at least they're leading men. That, of course, corresponds to the truth to a certain extent because they're pagans and pagans. You know? I mean, the cults of the Phoenicians, you know, with Ishtar and Baal and so, that this was something very different from the Greek cult. You know? And this was somehow aware of it. I do not know whether I answered your question. It is an important subject, that is quite true.
I don't...
Because he, you know, what is obvious, and evidently what everyone knows, is that there is a long discussion of Sabianism as the target of the Torah legislation, that part which Christians call the ceremonial law, and which Mormons call the chukim. That is anti-Sabian. That is very well known, but one must not forget that Maimonides also discerned a kind of concessions, and therefore kind of relics of Sabianism also in the text of the Bible.
I mean, this would be an adequate answer, at least at this, to the question if, instead of using the term Sabians, the term pagans or unbelievers had been used. But I was concerned with the specific use of this term, which in the Quran certainly does not refer to all kinds of pagans, but only to a very specific.
Maimonides means pagans.
Oh, he uses...
There is no question. He has this meaning. He also uses sometimes the term jahiliya, the ignorant, which is the Quran term for that. But there cannot be any question. He has, of course, also breakdowns of the pagans. For example, the Arabic, the Chaldeans, the Chaldeans, the Egyptians, and the Persians, and the Hindus, and the Greeks. And he makes the distinction between the more civilized of them, the Greeks, the Persians, and which is the third? I don't know. Perhaps the Persians, Greeks, Persians. I don't know whether the Egyptians, perhaps too. I don't know. And the others, you know, with the horrible sacrifice of children and so on. No, that is one of the greatest follies which we ordinarily commit is to believe that a historical perspective and a historical sense is an acquisition of the 19th or 18th century. Maimonides has an amazingly clear notion of the past. The more one understands, the more one sees that. I mean, he didn't have access to many things to which we have access today, but on the basis of the material, he was an amazingly careful and sober student of the past. And that was a very pertinent part of his work.
You speak of the use of homonyms, that is, the Bible refers to God, or names his attributes, and yet the names indicate nothing about God because they have only thing in common between the things ordinarily referred to and the attributes of the names. And it seems quite meaningless to name an attribute with a word that already has meaning when there is nothing shared between them.
Yeah, no, but I can answer that question if you give me about 5 minutes. Because that is what I would need. Now, Maimonides' doctrine of attributes to reduce to the simplest formula is this. All attributes are either negative or attributes of action. Negative attributes, for example, if we say God is wise, what we understand of that is only that he is not ignorant. But the character of his wisdom completely escapes. There is nothing in common with what we understand of it. Attribute of action, say God is a creator and the governor of the world. So the negative attributes are really only denials of imperfection, not more. The implication is, and the presupposition is, God's perfection is unfathomable. Anything we say about it is really mere words. God is the absolutely perfect being, the absolutely good being. Being absolutely good, being the good, there is no possible reason for creation, because the amount of good is not increased by creation. Now, but God, this absolutely perfect being, absolutely good being, has created the world. Has created the world is the comprehensive formula for all action. The absolutely good being is the formula for negative activities, because we do not have this unfathomable. Groundless action, an abyss, so to speak, which gave to us an abyss by virtue of his absolute goodness. And that means, of course, that the crucial implication of the doctrine of the attributes is this, that if you want to apply attributes to God, yeah, to the extent we cannot avoid it, will is somehow a bit better than this. Because will points more directly to the merely to the mere fact, which is to us unintelligible. So, from this point of view, one can say that Maimonides' doctrine of the attributes, so far from being a so-called derivation from Neoplatonism and what they say, that is a very technically very sophisticated expression. What's the Bible really mean? Therefore, he can sometimes use quotations, the verse, God has created things, lamah nihil, for his own sake. Yeah. We can't understand. We can only see that looking at things, trying to understand them, we cannot find any other ground which makes us intelligible except this unintelligible abyss of goodness. That, I think, is what the whole doctrine means.
In particular, for example,
but Maimonides says, you know, well, the famous difficulty is when you speak of the problem of divine providence and the future contingent, the famous story. Yeah? God knows in advance everything. Hence, he knows in advance that X will commit this sin. Is X not then determined by this foreknowledge? You know, an abyss of problem. There's no, what will you do? I mean, no distinction will help you, because the distinctions are only rather poor means for admitting a sick and unsolvable riddle.
Well, in particular, you say, when God is good, how can you understand this in terms of negative attributes?
Good means here that absolute perfection. This is here, Maimonides did not argue that out except very accidentally when he takes issue with the Epicureans, and let him argue from the alternative. Say the last sound of the world is even, and then you arrive at absolute absurdity. Because the very fact that you can realize it, proves that you can free yourself. To recognize something as evil is already incipient goodness. So, it belongs also to the world. And this kind of thing. But the point which is can be of importance in our discussion is only this. I do not believe that the doctrine of attributes, of course, it is the Jew brought up only in the biblical Talmudic tradition, will be greatly surprised. That goes without saying. But that does not yet mean that the doctrine may not bring out in a new medium. Yeah? In a new medium which was made possible by the influence of Greek philosophy, surely, what the Bible fundamentally means. That is surely not an Aristotelian teaching, and it is not even in the way in which Maimonides presents it, at any rate, what one could ascribe to Neoplatonism. The element of feel, I think, is so crucial, crucial for this Greek teacher. You mean the second subsection?
I think so.
Yeah.
Thank you.